Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life. It's the weekly show about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. We speak today with the Clean Air Network, Carl Ingwell. It's clean air, no excuses. That was the message taken to the state capitol last Saturday in a rally. The rally was also focused across the state in places like Moab. Carl Ingwell will join us by phone.
Good morning, Lynn Ware Peak. Then it's Mike Ritlin, former Navy SEAL and best-selling author. It's all about dogs, training your dog the Navy SEAL way. Not to worry, this isn't attack mode or anything of the sort. It's how to be in control and how to train your dog with this no-nonsense approach.
And finally, it's the science of touch and heart and mind with David Linden. He's the best-selling author of the book, Compass of Pleasure. He's the rare scientist who can write with wit and entertaining stories, this time about the power of touch. That's all coming up on The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, I'm Seth Adams, executive chef of River Horse on Main and a proud sponsor of The Splendid Table on KPCW. Winter is upon us, and we've revamped our menu to complement the cold weather. We offer Sunday brunch, dinner, and après-ski with views overlooking Main Street and live music nightly. 649-3536 or riverhorseparkcity.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, according to 2013 statistics, the American Lung Association ranked the Ogden, Clearfield, Salt Lake City area as the sixth most polluted city or cities in the United States affected by short-term particle pollution. And on the worst days of the inversion in the winter, the Salt Lake Valley can rival the air quality of places like Beijing. Of the many groups that have rallied to fight for clean air, we speak today with Carl Ingwell, who organized University Students Clean Air Network and was one of the organizers of the Clean Air No Excuses 2015 rally at the state capitol that took place last Saturday. He joins us now to talk about the rally and what is moving ahead or stalling regarding clean air in the state. Carl Ingwell, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Carl, will you first go over some of the various groups that are working towards achieving clean air in Utah?
Yeah, sure. So I think some of the hardest workers out there are the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, and they're kind of one of the more prominent groups, the groups that people really seem to kind of know. Utah Moms for Clean Air is also a very popular group along the Wasatch Front. And then you get into other kind of smaller satellite groups working on this. You have Clean Air Now, which is a group that I founded a few years ago. There is Communities for Clean Air, which they specifically work on the Stericycle issue, the medical waste incinerator in North Salt Lake. You have MESA. Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance. I really hope I got that right. So there are a handful of, and then HEAL Utah, excuse me. HEAL is another one of the big ones that everyone seems to know. And so there are a lot of different groups that have come together and really put this in the forefront as an issue that we work on.
Yeah, and are you coming together really as a collaborative effort, a coalition? You're all banding together to create a rally like you had on Saturday?
Yeah, we certainly all come together when we're doing kind of big things that make sense to work together, like the rally. Every one of those groups that I just mentioned was, you know, part of the planning process for the rally and put in a lot of hard work to put that on and get people out there last Saturday. So,
hey, Carl, I was down at the legislature last week, and the governor briefly spoke to the group that I was with, and clean air was one of the questions that was posed to the governor, talking about last year how the issue of clean air seemed to gain traction during the legislative session. I'm not sure what was passed and what wasn't passed. I believe the governor, though, talked about sort of the carry forward of that traction and momentum. And he said that last year there were a number of issues that were passed that addressed air quality, and he expects the same this year. Not a big comprehensive bill necessarily, but measures that address clean air. But he also made a comment, well, I'd like your thoughts on kind of the legislative session, but also he made a comment that the air in Utah today is cleaner than it was, I think he said, 30 years ago, and we've had a significant increase in the population. So he was saying that even though we've had population growth, we have more cars on the road, we have more factories putting pollutants into the air, we have taken measures that have been effective, we're on the right track, and we're going to do more. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, so let me kind of weave this into a long answer here, I guess. I can probably answer both of those questions at the same time. You know, the air certainly is. I wasn't around 30 years ago, so but from what I understand, the air is certainly getting cleaner than it was. That kind of sentiment often annoys me, I guess, in that you know, just because the air is cleaner doesn't make it necessarily healthy for everyone to breathe. A red air day is a red air day. Mm-hmm. And we should be trying to, you know, limit those red air days, or eliminate those red air days, rather. And it, you know, it doesn't really matter if it's 25 of them a year or one of them a year. And once you start reaching a certain level of particulate matter, the kind of negative health consequences are going to be there regardless of whether it's cleaner than it was 30 years ago or not. So our air is still perfectly unhealthy, and we had something like 25 red air days last year, and that's 25 too many. As far as the legislature is concerned, there are less bills in front of the legislature this year than there were last year. Last year, there were a number of bills passed and a number of good bills passed. They're all kind of bills that they're kind of smaller bills that won't have a huge impact. I'm not saying that smaller bills that won't have a huge impact aren't important. They, you know, if you add enough of those together, you're going to get a larger impact. So I think it's great that the legislature passed those bills last year. But we haven't seen any of what we've been calling the kind of like game changer bills that will have a huge impact on air quality here in the state of Utah. And that's kind of what a lot of the different groups have been looking for, is those big game changer bills. And we didn't see those last year. We're not really seeing a lot of that. This year there are a couple bills that we're following. There's a state law that makes it so Utah can enforce regulations that are stronger than EPA regulations. We think that we have a unique situation here in Utah with our climate, our geography, and we need to be able to have the ability to come up with unique situations for that, or unique solutions, excuse me, for that problem. And so this is a bill that's been put out there by Senator Gene Davis that would repeal that language in the law and allow the state of Utah to enforce regulations that are stricter than the EPA. And we're also working on another kind of a mass transit reform bill. It would give municipalities and counties the ability to put on the ballot a quarter of a cent sales tax increase, and that quarter of a cent would go into funding mass transit, which would be used to increase routes and frequencies and stuff like that.
Do you think, Carl, that the biggest game changer is going to be when people all are in agreement about what it's like to breathe air that's sometimes not breathable?
Sorry, could you, I guess, restate your question?
Well, I'm just wondering about the what will be the game changer in terms of collective consciousness when everyone says, well, you know, I choose not to burn wood because it creates bad air, you know, along with many other things, but really believing truly that the air we breathe is really important to our health. It seems that some people just, you know, haven't caught on to that yet.
Right. And I do think that's important. You know, I think that the kind of solution to this problem is multifaceted, and it's not going to just, I talk about the legislature a lot. It's not just going to come from the legislature. And it's not just going to come from industry. Everyone's going to have to buy in here. And one of the things I think that can make this easier is kind of improving the infrastructure for us to be able to buy in that, right? Like, it's really easy to say, oh, I should take the bus because the air quality is bad, and it's a lot harder to put something like that into practice. And I think that's where some kind of legislative goals come into play, like going back to the transit bill that I just talked about, you know, improving access to buses and getting people out of their cars is one thing that we'll need, because I'm a firm believer that, you know, personal vehicles and how we move ourselves around cities is one of the biggest impacts to air quality along the Wasatch Front. And so we know how to address that. We just need to be able to address that, if that makes sense.
Carl, I want to hit upon the game changer concept again just really quickly. We're almost out of time. But sure. I think at this point you've got the attention of the business community, because recently somebody from the governor's office said that he was on a tour with a potential business looking to relocate to Utah, and as soon as they hit that inversion, and it was a bad inversion day, they said, take us to the airport, send us home, we will no longer consider Utah. So that is a huge driver for this state, always has been, probably always will be, but you have the attention of the business community. They see it as unviable until we clean up our air. So given that, what is the game changer bill that you would like to see that could really tilt this thing in favor of making significant strides to cleaning up our air?
Well, you know, in the short amount of time that we have left, I don't know that I'm going to be able to answer that question. You know, there are certainly a lot of things that we could do, and I think, like, just going back to what I was saying earlier about how we move ourselves around the Wasatch Front, I think is very important. And you know, whatever bills we can do that make it easier for people to get out of their cars and get onto mass transit or active transit, I think the better. You know, certainly some of the other groups I mentioned earlier that I work with have other ideas of what a huge game changer bill would be, but some sort of mass transit overhaul and I guess mass and active transit overhaul in along the Wasatch Front would be something that I would see being productive.
Carl Ingwell is the founder of the group Clean Air Now and also one of the organizers of the Clean Air No Excuses 2015 rally held at the state capitol on Saturday. And Carl, just give us quickly the best place to go to find information if someone's interested in getting involved.
Sure. I think any of the groups I mentioned earlier, any of their websites, Heal Utah, check out their website. I believe it's healutah.org. UPHE.org, Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. And we're all connected on Facebook. So if any of those groups kind of interested you, you can check us all out on Facebook. It's Utah Moms for Clean Air, Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, Clean Air Now, Mesa, and Communities for Clean Air. I hope I didn't miss any of those.
I think you got it. All right. Great. Carl, thanks so much for your time and keep up the good work.
I always love being on your show, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye.
And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Mike Ritlin. He's the former Navy SEAL and best-selling New York Times, or rather, New York Times best-selling author of several books about training dogs. He's back now with a book about training your dog. It's Team Dog.
KPCW presents Terrence Simeon and the Zydeco Experience live on the Egyptian stage February 6th, 7th, and 8th.
I don't eat breakfast in bed. I don't eat no fancy food. But when it comes to how I love it, I'm always in the mood.
These two-time Grammy winners are the keepers of the culture of Southern Louisiana. Tickets at parkcityshows.com. The Egyptian is a nonprofit organization and proud supporter of KPCW.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank's Park City Branch, longtime supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your lending needs, from basic to complex loans. Our loan decisions are made locally. We have two branches in Heber and Midway and one branch in Park City. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital. Did you know Summit County has the highest rate of breast cancer in Utah? It's an alarming statistic, but one that can be changed with early detection. Mammograms save lives, and at Park City Medical Center, our team of skilled experts use the latest technology for the most accurate reading. We also offer soft robes, a private women's only center, and a special cushion called a mammopad to help make mammograms more comfortable. Call 658-7051 to schedule your mammogram today. It's a call that could save your life.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Our next guest, Mike Ritlin, is a former Navy SEAL and New York Times best-selling author. He combines his love of dogs with his Navy SEAL experience to lead one of the most successful canine programs in the country. He now writes about, or he wrote previously about canine warriors, and now he's back with a new book. It's about how to train your dog, Tim, if you had one, but how to train my dogs and all of those dogs out there, as Park City is Dog Capital USA. His book is Team Dog, How to Train Your Dog the Navy SEAL Way. We're very honored to have Mike Ritlin joining us by phone. Good morning to you, Mike.
Well, good morning. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you. So first of all, I have to say, when I looked you up and I found images of you, there was one very striking. I think it's you jumping out of a plane with a dog strapped to your chest. Was that you?
No, ma'am. That's not me. I know the picture you're talking about. It's actually a pretty popular picture, and it, for whatever reason, comes up a lot of times when you search my name. But no, that is not me. I wish it was, but it's a great picture, but no, it's not.
It is great. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your history training canine warriors and how that will be distinguished by your book now, Team Dog, about training our pets at home, our beloved pets.
Sure. Well, you know, the point of the book is actually that there's not much of a distinction between the two, and that, you know, the principles that are behind dog training are very, very constant, no matter what medium you're training in, whether it's, you know, explosive detection in the caves of Afghanistan, or you know, teaching you know, your mom's labradoodle to stay off the couch. The principles in which we use to train dogs to get them from point A to point B are the exact same. You know, again, no matter what that is. And so what I try to highlight in the book is that, you know, I've got a number of years of experience in working with dogs in working capacities in a whole number of varieties, different environments, you know, et cetera. And the things that I noticed were just that, is that that there's no difference between how I get a dog to do certain things no matter, you know, what environment I'm working in. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Go ahead. Finish what you were saying. I have another question.
Well, the key to that is, and what I highlight in the book is that, you know, you can't explain anything to a dog. You know, so you have to realize that first and foremost. Everybody knows what they want their dog to do, but they don't know how to communicate that to the dog. And so if you realize that dogs are not verbal and visual the way you and I are, but they are not very visual and overwhelmingly nonverbal in how they communicate both receptively and towards each other.
So you have to understand that first and foremost, and you have to be self-aware enough to be able to read what your dog is putting off body language-wise, and then use your own body to communicate back to that dog. And what I mean by that is carrying yourself a certain way. No different than, you know, if you compare how you interact with your dog to how you would, say, go for a job interview. You know, go to a job interview and interact with the people that are your potential bosses the same way that you interact with your dog. And if the answer is they would, you know, be laughing and send me out of the office immediately, then you're interacting with your dog wrong. You need to take that same approach, and that I'm going to be very stoic. I'm going to exude confidence and leadership, and make somebody, even if I don't say a word, when they look at me when I walk in the room, I give off a vibe of I know what I'm doing. I'm supposed to be here, and I'm looking in the face, and I'm very direct, and all of those things that we want to see out of people. How you present yourself to your dog, how he's going to perceive you. So if you act very foolish, very childish, very silly all the time, then guess what? That's what he's going to think of you. You know, now that doesn't mean that you can't be goofy and play games and have fun with your dog. But no different than, you know, small children, for example. You know, you should be able to tickle and roll around on the ground and play tag and be silly with them. But, you know, if you say, hey, it's time to clean up your room and you need to get dressed to go to school, and they say, no, we want to play tag instead, and they, oh, okay, yeah, let's do that instead, there's going to be no level of respect there, and you're going to have absolutely no control or authority over your household. And so that's the same problem you see with a lot of owners and their dogs.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about how the importance of choosing the dog. No doubt the many dogs that you trained while you were in the Navy SEALs are dogs that are trained for aggression and what else?
So you want to hear about those dogs or
well, I just maybe you know why you would choose those dogs and why someone like me would choose a different type of dog and why that's so important.
Sure. Well, you know, just like with most aspects in life, you know, the foundation sets the tone for everything else. You know, and so when you're looking at bringing on a potential dog, you need to look at the big picture, and then you need to look at the individual themselves. So by the big picture, I mean, do your diligence, do research on specific breeds and on, comparing and contrasting your lifestyle, your physical capabilities, how much time you have, environments in terms of what type of climate you live in. Is it conducive to the coat of the dog? Can you physically handle the size of the dog? Can you meet that dog's physical requirements in terms of, you know, mental and physical stimulation? Those are all things that you have to compile and bring together to decide, okay, this is the type or breed of dog that I want. This is the size of dog that's good for me. And then from that point, now you need to look at the individual. And one of the things I outline in the book is a number of different ways to test, select, and evaluate a potential candidate, that a lot of people don't think about. You know, things like loading the dog up in a crate and driving around a few times with it and see how it reacts, or taking it into an environment that you know it hasn't been in before and doing certain things with your body and putting it through a few exercises and seeing how it reacts to know whether or not this dog is going to be very skittish or very nervy or overly excited or, you know, things of that nature. And so it's a two-prong approach. You got to do the big picture first, narrow it down to the type of dog you want. Once you find that type of dog, then you need to make sure that individual dog is going to be a good fit for you and your situation.
Mike, I know a lot of smart dogs, and I honestly believe that. I mean, I don't own a dog currently, but through the years, I've always owned dogs, been in families with dogs, and it's unusual for me not to have a dog at this point in my life, but I don't. But it gives me a different perspective, and I interact and know a lot of what I would consider to be extremely smart dogs, and I'm wondering why there are so many naughty smart dogs. And I know a lot of these smart dogs that have been sent off to camp to get trained. And I'm also curious about, there's a connection there between the owners and the dog that you've already highlighted, and if the dog is going off to camp to be trained, what's happening with the owner while that dog is away, and isn't the owner a crucial and critical component of the dog being better behaved?
It absolutely is, and that's a great point to bring up, is that, you know, that's in essence what this book encapsulates, is that, you know, dogs are dogs. If it doesn't matter how great a dog is trained, if you don't know what you're doing, and I've seen it countless times, more times than I wish I had seen, and where a dog is phenomenally trained, it gets turned over to somebody that has no idea what they're doing, and they really ruin a lot of the training within a matter of weeks or months because they're doing a lot of conflicting and confusing things towards that dog. And so, you know, what I'm most proud about with this book is that, you know, it says, hey, you know, that the foundation of a relationship with your dog is just that. It's the relationship. It's the interaction that you have between you and your dog. There's no reason that everybody who owns a dog can't train the dog themselves. It's just it's a knowledge of power type of thing. And, you know, the best trained dog in the world in the wrong hands is gonna go back and revert to, you know, like you said, being quote unquote naughty. And a lot of times, more intelligent breeds figure things out in a nefarious way much faster. Mm-hmm. So it is imperative that we as owners, as handlers, as trainers, understand, you know, the basic psychology behind dogs and how to interact with them to capitalize on their strengths and eliminate their weaknesses and get that dog to a level that's commensurate with what our expectations are.
Now, Mike, on the other, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No.
On the other side of that same coin, I know dogs who are extremely well behaved, and yet it doesn't seem as though the owner has done anything in particular to create a well behaved dog. Is there at times just a coincidental match of the right dog in the right household, in the right family, in the right environment, that without any training, without any specific actions on the part of the owner, results in a you know, high-performing dog?
The short answer is yes and no. And by that, I mean there are instances where some dogs just naturally, genetically, you know, their inherited genetic traits are such that make them very, very easy to deal with. That's very rare, though. Usually, when you see a dog that's very well behaved and it seems like the owner has done nothing, even if the owner doesn't realize that they haven't been doing it the right way, that's usually what it is that no different than if you watch a brilliant stonemason or a sculptor do something, they make it look really, really easy. Mm-hmm. I may be dating myself here, but Bob Ross, for example, to watch him paint happy trees and all the other things that he makes, or watching anybody that's really, really good at something, they make it look excruciatingly easy. And you look at it and you're like, well, why can't I do that? You can do that. The reason it looks easy is because they're good at it. And again, some people have a natural inclination to do things the right way, even if they don't even realize it. Generally speaking, it's people who are good leaders, who run a tight ship, whether it's in business or their household or whatever else, are very organized, they're disciplined, they're consistent, and they work hard. You know, again, occasionally, yes, there are dogs that just seem to be super easy to deal with, but that's not the norm. That's an anomaly for sure. So the good news is by utilizing these principles and you know, taking these techniques to heart and putting the time in, anybody out there with any breed of dog can have the type of relationship they want if they want it bad enough and they're willing to put the time in to get there.
Now, Mike, I'm going to ask you a couple questions that are pertinent, maybe only to me, because I'm in the throes of puppy training. I got a Bernese Mountain Dog Border Collie mix for Christmas, and he's now 4 months old. And so my questions surround things like, and I know it'd be hard to answer this question, but, you know, about how much time do you need to devote each day, and I know it's each and every day, to training a puppy? I mean, Oscar's brilliant, but, you know.
Sure. Well, everybody's dog's brilliant, right? You know, the key to that is knowing the dog individually. You know, and one of the things I try to highlight in this book is there's not a cookie-cutter answer. You know, I look at training dog like climbing a tree. You know, we're all starting down at the base of the stump, and we're trying to get to the very top of the tree, and there's 1,000 different ways to navigate your way up there, and that's how individual dogs are. Having said that, with puppies, you know, their attention span is very, very short. And so what your best bet is to do multiple training sessions for just a few minutes per session where you know, the dog is positive, it's happy, it's a good learning environment, and I detail how to go about that in the book, how to set yourself up for success, you know, from a nutrition and exercise, mental and physical stimulation standpoint, which is very important, the same way it is for people, to kind of stack the deck in your favor, if you will, and then have very short, very positive training sessions where the dog learns a lot, it's fun, bam, and then we're done. And you do that multiple times a day. You know, repetition and consistency is your best friend. So, you know, some puppies can do 7 or 8 3 to 5 minute training sessions in a day. Some dogs you're better off doing 2 or 3. The point is to stick with it, stay at it, realize your dog's limitations, and try not to exceed those to where you're making things negative or confusing the dog and kind of burning them out.
Mike, what's the single biggest thing that people do with their dogs that you would call a violation that leads to bad behavior?
Unquestionably, it's how you carry yourself. That's the root cause of everything where I see problems. If your dog respects you and views you as the guy running the show, the sky is the limit, and it makes everything so much easier to teach, to train, to get them to be obedient, to follow rules, respect manners, you know, respect boundaries, all those types of things. And just like I was saying with the job interview thing, if you carry yourself in a very stoic manner, almost that you're allowing the dog to be in your household, and you're not coddling the dog, you're not, you know, bending over backwards to meet, you know, an imaginable need that the dog doesn't have, you know, and just maintaining that presence and exuding leadership, you know, that's the single most important aspect to having a well-behaved dog.
It's all so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today. The book is Team Dog, How to Train Your Dog the Navy SEAL Way. Mike Ritlin is the New York Times bestselling author of the book Trident, Canine Warriors. He's back with this book. And Mike Ritlin, thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, that was Mike Ritlin. Stay with us. We're back. From dogs to the science of touch.
The Glitter Tint at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tint restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tint serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended 645-6455.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Mike Ritlin.
I have some naughty dogs to call out. Newman, Toots, Baxter, you know who you are.
Hey, Jack didn't make the list, or Oscar.
Jack's a well-behaved dog. He's just sad.
Yeah.
And Oscar's brilliant, as you pointed out.
That's right. I hope they're not listening now. Oh, how we love our dogs. This is a really great book. We didn't get into it too deeply. Unfortunately, we didn't have the time, but wow. That was a concept I've never heard about, how you carry yourself, so that's a good one. Well, if you think about it, the sense of touch is the only sense of the five that is carried throughout your entire body, every square inch of it. And according to Johns Hopkins neuroscientist and our next guest, David Linden, touch really influences everything in life on very many different levels. Our guest, David Linden, has written a new book. It's The Science of Touch, and he's joining us now by phone. David Linden, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, touch. You know, I don't think many of us ponder touch in the same way that we ponder some of the other senses. Like, if you were to ask someone what they think the most important senses are, what do people say that I'm suspecting is not touch?
Well, most people think of vision or of hearing every once in a while. Someone like a chef will say smell or taste. But I think part of the reason we don't think about touch is that we can't imagine losing it. We take it for granted. So you can close your eyes and imagine what it's like to be blind, or plug your ears, or pinch your nose and imagine losing those senses. But touch is always on, and as a consequence, it's hard to conceptualize the loss of touch.
Right. So as a neuroscientist, what What got you interested in touch?
Well, I got interested in it for really two entirely different reasons. One of them is I started to think about, you know, what were the experiences in my life that were the most central, that were the most important to me, and I realized they were, you know, hugging my kids and my sweetheart and having that interpersonal touch, that this was really the glue that bound me in a family, in a romantic relationship. And at the same time, I work here at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, which just turns out to be the center for touch research, leading center for touch research in the world. And so I had lunch with all my colleagues, and I would hear about the terrific advances going on in their laboratories. And really, I became a fanboy of touch research. I don't conduct it in my own laboratory, but I'm a big admirer. So I decided I wanted to be the ambassador from the nation of neuroscience, if you will, to give bring the good word about touch to everyone else.
David, you just said that touch is that one sense that we can't really deprive ourselves of, so we take it for granted because we can't. We can't step to the other side where we don't experience it, but are there people who do not experience any sensation of touch physically?
Well, there are people who lose certain aspects of touch. So you can have a genetic illness where, for example, you lose your ability to sense pain. It's called congenital total insensitivity to pain. It's very rare. And these people can feel light touch and pressure and moderate temperature, but they can't feel pain or extremes of temperature. And you might think, oh, what a great way to live. No pain. How blissful. But it turns out that these people have terrible lives because pain is there to protect you from damaging things, and they typically consume hot food and drink and burn their esophagus, wear clothes too tight that dig into their skin. They don't know to limp when they've had an injury, and then they make the injury worse, grinding their joints away. So if you can't sense pain, it's hard to live past the age of 25 or 30, actually.
Wow.
And then there are other people who have a disease called primary sensory neuronopathy, and they are really the closest to being so-called touch blind. They can still sense pain and some aspects of temperature, but if you were to touch someone on the arm or the leg, they would only have the vaguest sensation of what's going on. They really wouldn't even notice it in most cases and couldn't really pinpoint the sensation or tell you the quality of the touch at all.
Well, for the most part, so the quality of touch, that's where I was going to go next, because I'm wondering, you framed that mainly from the perspective of pain, not registering levels of pain that act as protection for us, but it would seem like you would also lose the sensation of pleasure. If you don't have the pain sensation, do you still have the pleasure sensation? But then that gets into how our brains process what's happening through the sense of touch.
It does indeed. And it turns out that touch is actually many, many different sensors lined up in your skin in parallel. So if you were able to look at your skin and see the nerve endings, you would see some that are specialized for heat, some for cold, some for pain, some for itch, some for fine texture, some for pressure, some for vibration. And all these different streams of information come to the brain, and they actually kind of segregate into two basically different systems. One, located in a region called the somatosensory cortex, is there to give you the facts about touch. What is the quality of touch? Where is it on my body? How strong it is? Oh, it's a light texture like corduroy being rubbed over my right index fingertip with moderate pressure, right? That's the facts about touch. And then there is a separate emotional touch system in the brain that's located in a completely different brain area called the posterior insula. And that area is there to give the emotional tint to touch, both positive and negative. So when you receive a caress on the arm, there are special caress sensors that strongly activate this emotional touch region. And if you have an orgasm, you will be activating that region. And if you have chronic pain, you'll be activating that region for negative emotion.
Let's go to this emotional touch. I think most of us have heard how important touch is for an infant, that if they don't get touch, they will not develop correctly. So talk about that. Expand on that for a minute.
Well, yes, this is amazing. So, you know, if a kid is born blind, they're fine. If a kid is born deaf, they're fine. If a kid is born and they don't receive loving touch as a newborn, as a toddler, then a disaster unfolds. And the disaster is that they have terrible attachment disorders, cognitive function, mood disorders, and then not just neuropsychiatric problems, but problems with the development of the digestive system and the immune system, higher incidence of obesity, and these problems aren't just there in childhood. They actually persist throughout life. So loving touch in early life is not optional for human development. It's absolutely necessary.
David, using that example with the kids, I mean, we've known there have been studies about depriving animals and children of touch and the consequences. But now it seems, as we're learning with a lot of these studies that have to do with the brain, that there's like a whole nother branch of understanding has opened up. And we've heard from other people we've interviewed that a lot of that has to do with the current technology, the ability to look into the brain and see what's actually going on. And is that part of what's happened for your research and your studies?
Well, yes, absolutely. In other words, we wouldn't know where the emotional touch circuit in the brain, in the human brain, was located if we didn't have brain scanning machines. And we wouldn't be able to pinpoint some of these phenomena and do things like find the itch receptor identify it molecularly in mice in the laboratory if we didn't have the ability to analyze gene expression in cells and to record electrical signals from neurons with electrodes implanted into the brain and all of these modern scientific techniques.
And so where do you see those modern scientific techniques if you were to project out over the next 5 to 10 years? Because I think a lot of this has happened in just the last 10 years where we're able to see inside the brain. Is that technology still developing at the same pace? And do you see the same sort of breakthroughs and new areas of understanding in the next 10 years?
Oh, absolutely. It's the golden age right now. And the thing you have to realize about things like brain scanning machines is they're actually quite crude. They're slow. They average activity over seconds, whereas brain electrical activity changes on the order of thousandths of a second. And also, they have a very bad spatial resolution. So the finest you can see on a brain scanning machine is about a cubic millimeter of tissue. But within a cubic millimeter of tissue, there's more neurons than there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. What you really want to do is to be able to interrogate every neuron separately without sticking anything into the brain. Right. So right now, the techniques we can use for laboratory animals, we can interrogate individual neurons. But those techniques are ones that, in most cases, unless it's in the middle of neurosurgery, most cases we're not going to do with humans. And with those techniques, we are limited to this cruder view. Now, there will be imaging technologies developed within the next 10 or 20 years that will change that enormously. I think it's useful to talk about what in the realm of touch people can expect in terms of medical advancements. One example right now is that if you go to have a lot of surgery, like dental work, for example, you get an injection of lidocaine in your mouth, and it's a terrible drug. It blocks all the sensation, and it blocks your ability to move your muscles. It's not specific. But now we've identified proteins in the pain-carrying neurons that are responsible for their electrical activity. So people are actively trying to produce topical analgesics that will block the pain but leave every other sensation intact. Likewise, there's just been molecular identification of itch receptors. And so right now, therapies for itch are pretty bad, and a lot of times they don't work. Anyone who's ever had poison oak or poison ivy knows that. And within the next 10 years, that will improve enormously. You will see terrific therapies being developed for itch, and this is exactly what flows from this work, both in the laboratory animals and in the human clinical work.
Boy, I was a kid too early because I spent a lot of time scratching poison ivy when I was young. David, I wanted to ask you about massage therapy and if any of your research has identified the benefits of receiving massage or possibly even giving massage.
It turns out that there are benefits for both receiving and giving massage. So the world's leading expert in this is a woman named Tiffany Fields from the University of Florida, and she has her own book that I recommend for people who are interested in massage therapy from MIT Press. That's just in its second edition. It's a terrific book. And what she has found is that for people with chronic pain, there are enormous benefits to receiving massage. For premature infants, there are terrific benefits from receiving massage. And for normal aging in the elderly, massage is great. The elderly, particularly in institutional settings, oftentimes receive very little social touch. And this tends to depress mood and contribute to feelings of isolation. And in that context, massage has enormous benefits for mood, for motor function, flexibility, continued engagement with the world.
I like the study I heard once that said that massage is probably more effective than stretching. And I love that because, you know, I can just lay there and receive a massage. Stretching is kind of work.
Well, you know, the thing is there's a lot to be said for stretching and self-massage as well. Mm-hmm. So there is some benefit to rubbing yourself.
Yeah.
It's not as good as receiving a massage from someone else, but if it's the middle of the night and there's no one around and you've got pain, giving yourself a rub is actually a beneficial thing to do.
Our guest is David Linden. He's the author of the book Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And it's funny, throughout this conversation, David, I keep turning back to thoughts of my puppy that I got for Christmas. And in touch with this dog, I have noticed produces such great effects. For example, if he's left alone one day and he's not interacted with and not especially touched, he becomes a very bad dog. And when I'm with him, if I constantly touch him, it just makes such a huge difference. So I just keep going back to this dog, even though I love touch among humans as well.
And it's good for the dog, and it's also good for you. The benefit flows both ways in that interaction. It turns out that elderly folks who have pets with whom they interact through touch tend to do much better as they age. Now the problem is that particularly in some institutional settings, you can't have pets. There are reasons people are allergic, or you just can't arrange it within that kind of a living facility, and so there are places that have experimented with using furry little robots. There's a robotic seal from Japan called Paro, a little harp seal pup, and it's in the early indications, it's been very effective to draw out particularly elderly people with dementia.
Interesting. Maybe that's also on the other end of the spectrum of age, why children have stuffed animals, because it's important for them to learn touch.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, kids are deeply tactile and explore the world through that nature. And, of course, it gets fraught when they become adolescents. My kids go to a Quaker youth group, and one of the things I like about it best is that, like, they're always kind of in these puppy piles all over each other. And I think it's great for them to learn that you can have interpersonal touch that's neither aggressive nor sexual in nature, that is just bonding you with your friends.
Yeah. So interesting that many miss that fact. Many of us do. Interesting.
There's a great short story by the wonderful writer Laurie Moore where she describes a lonely woman and how she lives for going to have her hair cut because she likes the touch in the salon, and how when she goes to the airport with the TSA, she always opts for the pat-down because no one touches her any other way.
Okay, that's weird.
I mean, it's a terrific story, but it points out how central interpersonal touch is to our lives.
Exactly.
David, that's interesting because that's kind of what I was going to talk about or ask you about for as the next area of exploration, because we're talking about people who either don't get enough touch or get just the right amount of touch or the benefits of touch, and people who crave touch. Is it possible for us to get too much touch? And I don't mean, you know, the wrong kind of touch, not the sort of touch that would evoke an emotional response that is negative. I just mean too much of the good kind of touch. Can you be overwhelmed with touch?
Well, generally speaking, mostly not. I mean, I think the thing to realize is that the way we experience touch is not just through the raw sensation, but through the context. I mean, think about this from your own experience. The very same arm around the shoulder literally feels different if it's coming from a domineering boss, or your good buddy, or your sweetheart, or someone hitting on you sexually. The very same physical sensation feels different as a result of context. And this is because the higher areas of the brain that process context and social interaction are influencing the areas of the brain that produce the touch sensation. In terms of getting too much touch, one area where this comes up has to do with masturbation. And particularly for men, you can have a situation where if you engage in masturbation very frequently, you essentially desensitize the touch endings, and it can become much harder to achieve orgasm through either solo or partnered sex.
Hmm. Very interesting. I think we have to leave it there, David, but it's such a fascinating topic. We could go on. There's so many different avenues to take it in, aren't there?
It's a great topic. That's why I chose it. Yep.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, that was David Linden unraveling the science of touch. And very fascinating. The book title is The Science of Touch, Heart, and Mind. Very good. I like that stuff.
And you should. You're a massage therapist.
Yes, it's true. Okay. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after these messages.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake. Info at hideoutcanyon.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law. LRW-law.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
You let your cat outside one day and he comes back 3 days later, completely groomed. Only in Park City.
And only in Park City could a town build a radio station like KPCW. Support community journalism by supporting KPCW during our Winter Pledge Drive, February 9th through 13th. Because only in Park City can public radio sound this quirky.
Donate during the pledge drive and get thank you premiums from local restaurants like
Butcher's Chop House, Squatters, The Eating Establishment, and Shabu.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. Want to thank our guests, Carl Ingwell of Clean Air Now, Mike Ritlin, former Navy SEAL and author of the book Team Dog, How to Train Your Dog the Navy SEAL Way. I'll be reading that book cover to cover, even though Oscar is brilliant. And finally, David Linden. He's the author of The Science of Touch, Heart and Mind. And want to thank our underwriters,
Park City Bonanza Instacare, Berkshire Hathaway Home Service Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, and Heber Valley Bank.
And be sure to tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Cool Science Radio. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Time now for news.